You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Joining me is the owner of the longest pubic hair that's ever set foot on Range 7 in Quantico, Colonel Phil Smith, USMC retired. I know. He for some reason, he decided that he should share that with me, and so I've been scarred by it ever since. I've got a question for you. First of all, first question, are you surprised that the Navy charged the commanding officers of the McCain and the Fitzgerald with negligent homicide, as well as dereliction and some other charges? That surprise you at all?
No, I would have been surprised if they were not charged with either one of those charges.
All right. What are your thoughts on the ability to convict? There's no doubt that their negligence led to the death of those sailors. And I would tell you in particular on McCain, where the sea and anchor detail, which is more experienced navigators, more experienced watchmen, more experienced helmsmen, were recommended by the XO and the OPSO before they headed into the straits, and he rejected it. And so I think in the case of the McCain, the preponderance of evidence is that guy didn't do his job very well. So
yeah, two different instances. I think the Fitzgerald made no effort to move. If you look at the track of the boats, the Fitzgerald didn't move when it was clearly obliged to move to avoid the crossing of the bow. But the McCain actually moved; it just moved in the wrong direction. And then, if you read the report, the frickin' CO. Just minutes before they changed direction, he saw the helmsman struggling with the speed control and the steering, so he separated. He sent one of those functions to another office space, and nobody knew it.
to the aft space, right? And then what they don't realize, the guy at the forward helm doesn't realize, is that the throttles are not synced. They're uncoupled. You can operate those independently of each other, and then you can operate them synced, right? What he doesn't realize is that they're not synced. And so one propeller is shut down, essentially, which would be the port propeller is shut down. All right, that would be the left one. The starboard propeller continues to turn at, I want to say, 18 knots. And so
it turns to
the left in front of this merchant vessel that is just on the straightest track you've ever seen through the Moluccan Straits. And so, very different. But again, the reason those people are in those positions are because he refused, under the advice of his XO and his OPSO, that the sea and anchor detail be set earlier than it was. He said, "Nah, we got this. We got this." And
so very, very poor leadership judgment, understanding what's going on in his crew, led to this thing. I mean, it's just nuts. He needs to go away.
Well, you know, I many years ago I heard the term "no attrition, no morale," and I remember the first time I heard it, I thought, well, what the hell does that mean? And what my experience taught me is that what it does mean is when these kind of things happen, somebody needs to pay and be held accountable, or else the institution suffers. For us to say, okay, you know, yeah, that was unfortunate. We can work harder and work better together, and next time we go to sea, nobody's going to get killed. Yeah, sorry, boys. That's not the way this shit works.
To their credit, the Navy's always been pretty good about holding its commanders responsible, much more than I think a lot of the other services do. I mean, you know, the commanders of the ship is where, you know, the pointy end of the spear is. The pointy end of the spear is not down in the well deck. It's not down in an engine room. It's in that CO. He is responsible for that, that platform. And I like the way the Navy's always, held them accountable and responsible. Even if they, you know, the guy, runs the ship aground, doesn't matter what the reason is, he's gone.
Right.
I mean, so I've always liked the way that the Navy has done that. And I would have been very surprised if it hadn't, held these guys accountable this way. So I think they're toast.
Okay. All right. I want to ask you a question about fake news. Senator Flake stood up and John Ubaldi and I were talking about it, but, he almost, it seems like he wants to take us back to Never Never Land. Dorothy's going to show up. There is no Wicked Witch. The Senate works together. The media is devoted to the truth. That's not the world that we live in anymore. And I don't, I think that the president's fake news awards, are grossly unprofessional, but I wish he didn't have to go there, but the truth is that the media hasn't gotten over his election. And so we've all learned that they don't report well, that they report consistent with their own agenda. Give me your thoughts on that. How do you be the chief of staff of the White House, and what advice do you give the president when he looks at you and says, Smitty, what do you think?
Well, I think the advice would be that, Mr. President, your instinct to fight back and to confront and to expose is the correct one. However, I do not think that you should be the one doing it. I think you need to have your communications director or perhaps your chief of staff or perhaps someone else in the administration. Maybe you divvy it up depending on what the specific topic of it is, like your DHS secretary on immigration issues. I mean, that stuff should never get to the CO or the president until, you know, all fire has been delivered by the subordinate. So I think that's what he should do. I think he is calling way too much attention to himself, when I think the issues that he's fighting is what is really what needs to be brought to the fore and pressured.
I'm going to be the president. Here we go again, Smitty, you with the choir boy stuff. Okay. Smitty, did you not see the way I got elected? Did you not see what was instrumental in my election? That was my dialogue with the American people. The American people aren't going along with this. That's why they elected me. So why do you want to put me in the can?
Well, because...
Yeah there you go. First of all, don't say well. Say, you should say something, Mr. President, okay? Well, Mr. President, when you address me.
What? Well, Mr. President, times have changed, and if you want to get reelected in 2020, which I know you do, and the country wants you to, the attention needs to shift from you, the person, to you, the issues. And the issues are presented by your cabinet. When you were being elected, you did not have a cabinet.
You're fired. You're fired. your ass is so fired. It's a joke.
But that's what I think. I mean, that's what we're all complaining about is that he is constantly in the news with his tweets about what it is that is important to him and so on and so forth. And he keeps the pressure on it. And I think actually he could have a strategic reason why he's doing this. Every time he tweets, every time he talks, in oral language, in the tweet written language, it right. distracts the entire news organizations away from what he's really doing. In other words, a lot of people do action and they say little. He says a lot and he does a lot of action, and it's the actions that we're not really getting good press coverage on because they are constantly being distracted by what he says. So that seems to be working for him, because if you look at what he's done, And, you know, one of the news organizations, the newspaper, Washington Post, keeps a running tally of all the things that he's doing. Executive legislation, economic, environment. And it's huge. It's huge. It's good stuff. I mean, those are the reasons why your economy is just, you know, off to the races.
Right. Again, the Dow floating at 26,000 right now, which is crazy. Stuff. And all anybody has to do, and were I the president and continuous this dialogue, I would say, Smitty, you know how I'm going to get reelected? And you'd say, yes, Mr. President. And I'd say, why don't you stand up when you're talking to me? But as long as you're sitting down behind your big desk on your ass talking to the President of the United States, why don't you open that top drawer and get out your 401k for any one of your 401k plans? And let me tell you how I'm going to get reelected. Yeah, that's how I'm going to get reelected, okay? Because they can talk all the shit they want, but only one guy's delivered on that 401k stuff, and that is D. Trump.
Yep.
All right?
Yep.
That is D. Trump.
I think
you're
right.
But so again, I just I lament that we don't live in the world that Jeff Flake described, where the Senate acts as one. You know, again, the truth be told, the Senate is the most obstructive organization in American democracy. Those senators have incredible power to hold up anything, and they do. And their whole adopted rule of filibuster that was not part of what the Founding Fathers created is one of the great impediments to getting things done in our democracy. Yet they seem to think that there's some kind of virtue in it. I don't get it, but they do. Now, if we lived in a world of that kind of cooperation and the media reported, you know, or largely focused on the truth, then I absolutely agree. But that's Pollyanna bullshit. You know, and again, I told you, but I'm not the biggest fan that Donald Trump has, but you know, the truth is the truth, except when you push it in front of the face of journalists at CNN, right, at MSNBC, at NBC, they don't want to hear it because they don't like him. And the conservative agenda, you can stick that up your ass.
Well, is it not the case that all of the mainstream media are actually reporting events as truth? What they're providing in a distorted manner is their particular opinion of the truth. Isn't that what we're all kind of flummoxed about?
Well, I would ask you this. If you're a reporter, you don't have an opinion. You just report facts. You write stories, right? Columnists editorialize. You give opinions, and editorial writers write editorials. They're separate functions.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right there. I mean, the editorial, the reason why you write an editorial is because you have an opinion about a piece of action or a piece of truth or a piece of information. But the news organizations, I mean, every one of them now have these analytic analyzers, and they have established the medium by which opinions and perspective is communicated, and it's all about influence at this point. They are trying to influence their audience in a certain manner, one way or another. Not that that's the problem, is they are becoming, you know, George Orwell's Ministry of Truth.
Oh, George Orwell, man. We live in a day and age that Orwell could not even imagine.
I think so.
When your phone tracks everywhere you go, right? Everything you say, every picture you take, you're a little bit beyond what Mr. Orwell could conceive of when he wrote 1984. Okay, so your advice to the president would be, yeah, back off a little bit. Don't let your flunkies take care of it. That would be your advice?
On select issues, yeah, I think so. Just because that way the actual truth of the issue, the actual action that's being taken, can actually be presented by, you know, the cabinet member that's pushing it through. And it'll have a very difficult time being challenged then, because we know that every time president, you know, says something, it's challenged automatically. It's a good.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily the case when your subordinates go out there and do it, although They haven't shown a pretty good effort to do that, but that would cause the media to split their forces and go after all these different subordinate things instead of focusing all their ire and attention on one voice. Divide and conquer type of thing.
Divide and conquer kind of thing. Okay. All right. I don't know. I think he is do you think this changes the landscape? For instance, I mean, I asked John Ubaldi, I'll ask you the same thing. I mean, the press conference yesterday was only about fake news, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that whole hour devoted to his body and his brain, to include the cognitive test he took, is all a response to reporting from news agencies that obviously has no basis in the fact. And it's like when you watch them ask the questions, they're sitting there with a Navy surgeon and they don't believe him. They don't want to believe him.
Yeah,
right. To it, the guy who said, how can this guy who doesn't exercise a whole lot, who loves McDonald's, who drinks Diet Cokes, how can you tell us he's in excellent health? It's called genes, bro. It's called genes. Damn it!
Yeah,
Damn it! This screws up the whole. The guy thinking this screws up the whole narrative.
Yeah, and I think it was exactly the correct thing to do. Rather than wait until the press gets a hold of a report, you go out there and you lead from the front and you say, "Hey, here it is. Take it or leave it." And I think I heard someone say that that doctor stayed out there and was told to stay out there until every question was answered. He didn't leave it an hour because the press conference was done. He stayed until every question was answered. That's the way to do it. You got to get out in front of these guys and lead with your perception of the truth. Don't let them respond to it.
Yeah. Well, again, I just said, do you think this changes the land? So if you were contemplating running for office, would you say that, hey, Donald Trump has changed the way candidates communicate? You're now Schleprock if you communicate the old way.
You mean minus tweets?
Yeah, like you, like Smitty delegated to his subordinates a response to NBC saying that you only have one ear and are unqualified to job. That's how you would do it? Or do you think candidates are looking at this saying, nah, man, he's engaged. He outcycles. I mean, one of the things that Smitty and I, have studied for years is maneuver warfare. And one of the concepts is you're outcycling your opponent. You're doing it faster than they can respond to it. And it's one of the things that he does. He gives them more than they can digest. And then he's always on to the next issue. Boom, next one. Boom, next one. So do you think he's rewriting the way political candidates interact and the way they do things?
I think so. And I think if anybody's watching and listening and about how quickly influence and people's perception of a particular issue changes or is informed, they're going to have to do it by this means. Otherwise, they're going to consistently be out cycled. Until somebody comes up with a better way to, deflect tweeting and slow down the timing of it. In other words,
the media cycle, right? How do you slow it down? Because now it is what it is. If you're not in that arena, then you've ceded it to him at his tempo, at him out cycling you.
Yep.
I think again, for better or for worse, all right, now here's a question for you. The Associated Press is reporting that Trump's lawyer was on the phone with the White House in terms of his interview or with the Intelligence Committee. And claiming executive privilege. Is that to be expected? Is that a shocker? Give me your thought on that.
It's to be expected. I think that's the first, line of defense that goes out there until they get to the bottom of the agenda, of what it is that's to be talked about. I think the president should talk, but he's not going to until he understands what the agenda is, what the questions are, and all this other stuff. So the first thing that they get out of the way is, okay, executive has, their privileges, doesn't need to talk to you guys. And then that's the way they'll get to the bottom of what the agenda is. But I think eventually he'll talk.
I
don't think he'll ever talk to Mueller. I think he'll talk to the committee, but I don't think he'll talk to Mueller.
Interesting. All right. The let me ask you a Marine Corps question here. In terms of equipment, we've seen the Commandant make overtures that he's going to re-kit every Marine. Every infantry Marine, at least, with more and more specialized equipment. Your thoughts on that? You made a prediction the last time you were on, when I was asking you to predict 2018, and you said, the Marine Corps, will embrace more historically special operations missions in its MUs and in its UDP battalions. Your thoughts on the Marine Corps really bringing its infantry in to closer to special operations equipping? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? And is it a particularly difficult thing for the Marine Corps because of this concept of every Marine's a rifleman, even though we won't get into that discussion? But, I remember being involved. I remember being General Mattis's staff sec and seeing the traffic, and later dealing with it in current ops when I went there. 1-3 shows up from Hawaii and says, "Where's our ACOGS?" And you look at them and say, "Well, that was a 1st Division purchase. Did 3rd Division buy them for you? Well, wait a minute. Like, why don't we get theirs? Why didn't you buy yours? Wait a minute. And then you have the FSSG. It used to be the FSSG. Now, MLG saying, well, wait a minute. What about us? And so this whole concept that our infantry guys can't have different equipment than everybody else, which ultimately hurts the infantry guys, who close with and destroy. So your thoughts about those subjects?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that specialized equipment equates to an organizational or mission shift closer to that of Special Operations Command or Special Operations Forces. It could, but it would depend on what the institutional mission would be and the purposes for doing it, and then what organizational structures have been created or modified to reflect the mission statement. So right off the bat, I think if he's talking about equipment already before the shift towards special operations like missions have been done, that's asked backwards.
Okay, he is.
Do people first.
He is. The discussion is we're still working on equipment that is 10 years old for a lot of different reasons, but to be able to outfit with modern communications that are integrated into your helmet, a more modern optic that would include a thermal capability, those things that somebody that looks at equipment says, yeah, that stuff is off the shelf ready now. It is no longer Buck Rogers space age stuff, but it is stuff that, that is, you can buy off the shelf, along with some kind of body armor that cuts that weight in about half, that people were toting around in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think it's kind of separate issues. One is, and I understand what you're saying, that ideally it ought to be missions and then we design equipment specifically for those missions. But I think the premise is our equipment is antiquated. We need to bring it up, and then we're also considering this other stuff there. This equipment will absolutely support those mission sets. Now that I said that, what say ye to that?
I think it's still ass backwards.
You're done. You're off the program. You're done.
But anyway, I still think it's a good idea. You got to have, modern communications equipment. You've got to have, there's no reason why they can't talk to themselves at the push of a button. They should all be seeing what everybody else sees, particularly at the squad level. The problem with all of that is, as we may have talked before, is the inclination of leaders to over and micromanage and make decisions for these guys on the ground with all that kind of common operational picture. It's just too much of a human nature to not get involved and make decisions for the guys on the ground.
Well, you know, there's an article in Marine Corps Times yesterday about that somebody thinks it's a good idea to have a scope it might be a sniper weapon, but that can transmit what you're seeing through the reticle. That way the division opso can tell you whether or not to pull the trigger.
Oh my.
That's exactly, I said the last thing.
Somebody needs to push back on that. You know, somebody's forgetting what it's like on the battlefield, and it's not going to get any better.
What are we going to do with that?
Our use and application of technology is not going to reduce the character and the nature of a fight. It's just not going to.
I'm going to make you feel good, Smitty. I'm going to. This moment of clarity is brought to you by me. Okay, now. It is a quote from a book entitled A Bias for Action. Okay, now it's one of my favorite quotes of all time, and it talks about Rommel led the 7th Panzer Division into France. Okay. So I'll read. In Russia, this is from, it's written by Dr. Russell Stolfi. And it's entitled A Bias for Action. You could probably find the PDF online right now. In Russia, 7th Panzer Division advanced without Rommel even more effectively than it had in 1940. The Russian experience tells us that the genius of the division went far beyond one man. The great advances of the 7th Panzer Division in Russia were based on self-confidence and initiative among commanders, staff, rank and file, qualities that focus on rapid action in war. I'm not sure how the video link sniper scope contributes to that. The senior commanders of the 7th Panzer Division allowed subordinate leaders to make mistakes. The tolerance of these leaders was never an excuse for slipshod performance. It was a calm recognition that rapid action in the face of uncertainty will result in errors that can be overcome by more action. German command style pivoted on taking action in war, demanded that subordinate leaders take such action, and accepted the mistakes that would naturally occur. With such a style, the leaders of the 7th Panzer Division understood uncertainty as an omnipresent reality and rode with it to victories that cry out for emulation.
Now, yeah, we're gonna have to change our leadership traits and principles and remove all reference to trust your subordinates.
Yeah, once we get
that's what's gonna happen.
Once we get trust, but look through their reticle.
Yeah. Ask somebody else. Make sure that what we're seeing is correct. It's actually going to slow down the decision-making time. It's not going to speed it up. Because the whole basis of it is unbelief and distrust of what you're seeing. If you don't believe what your subordinate is telling you, then how are you going to believe what he's actually sending you in a picture? You're not. You're going to ask, hey, is that real true?
Yeah, but I can tell him whether to pull the trigger or not. And that way the general, he's not going to get pissed as much at me.
Yeah, he won't go to jail that way. Yeah, that's right. It's all about legal.
There you go. Now that we've got on Monday, the nation remembered the birthday of Martin Luther King. What you came in the Marine Corps? What year? 70s, right?
Enlisted in 73 and boot camp 74.
Father Time here on the radio. What You, hey, by the way, you got a lot of white hair. Where did that come from?
Yeah, it's genetics, man.
Is it? Holy
yep.
Shit! I'm losing mine. I won't. Yeah, you won't be teasing me about white hair.
Yeah, my daughter is pissed at me too because her hair's already turned white. And she's not yet 35.
Yeah, but come on. Most women don't even know what color their hair originally was, right?
Yeah, they change it quite frequently.
Yeah, so I mean, come on. Let's get real with that. Like, whoa, you're mad because it's underneath all those like seven different tones that you've had over the last few years that it's a little bit white. Come on. Now.
Yeah.
The racism in the Marine Corps. Did you experience it?
No, not to the degree that I think a lot of people did. I missed, I believe in the late 72, early 73, there were a few race riots in Lejeune. I missed all that. Of course, I didn't go to Lejeune until later, but, I was in, San Mateo first, and I don't recollect seeing a lot of that. I may have been, a little bit maybe too high and mighty to see it, but,
what do you mean? You were a PFC Lance Corporal?
PFC Lance Corporal, yeah. High and mighty, meaning I didn't associate with a lot of the guys, just because we thought a little bit differently. But the drugs, I recall, as being the big issue.
Drugs a bigger issue in the Marine Corps relative to more than race?
Well, probably about the same with regards to the amount of time that was spent by leadership on trying to get the handle on it, but I do remember human relations training, which was the big headquarters Marine Corps program at the time that was supposed to put all Marines in a circle and talk about the things of obvious time type of a thing, and it was targeted at trying to understand and get at the racial issue, but I don't remember the problem specifically. Certainly if you were in a unit where somewhere in Camp Lejeune, you would have been probably more attuned to it. But and then after about a year in 29 Palms, but Camp Pendleton, I went to Hawaii, and I didn't see any issues there either. So perhaps protected from it somewhat.
Only by the people you associated with. But, I mean, you were still in units that if it was present, that there's a lot of times. It's not like
My best buddy in boot camp, a fellow squad leader was a black guy. Got along fine. I mean, I didn't even see any of that kind of issue in boot camp in February, March, and April of 74.
And you went to, you were San Diego?
San Diego, yeah.
Hollywood Marine.
Yep.
Interesting. No, you know, it's interesting. You know, the Marine Corps most resistant to most integration efforts, be it gender, be it race. We were the slowest to pick up on both those. So interesting. And then once the Marine Corps embraces it, though. I was talking to General Droughty. He said, for whatever reason, once we embrace it, we seem to execute it with, maybe with greater enthusiasm than most. So it's kind of interesting. Maybe the other services would roll their eyes at that and say, yeah, whatever. That's your own rationalization for pushing back. But the race thing, General Holcomb is quoted as saying, if I could have 250,000 black Marines or 5,000 white Marines, I would choose the 5,000. Like, what?
That's probably not too good of a thing to say.
Yeah. No, and then the other thing General Droughty talked about was that, for whatever reason, the Marine Corps had a fair number of officers that were from the South. And their pushback, probably notable, throughout the 40s and the 50s in terms of black Marines. And so maybe another reason why the Marine Corps was late. But again, it's interesting because General Droughty told me the same thing yesterday. He said, I just didn't experience that much racism in the Marine Corps once the order was given to integrate. Now, I know there was racial incidents, And then he said, maybe I'm having an old person's moment, but I don't realize, because Mac, he said, it didn't, you know, it certainly did not matter to me. Well, the only thing that mattered was you were a Marine.
And I think from my perspective, and maybe his, I didn't hear his talk, but perhaps indirectly over the years, as I, you know, became commissioned and then platoon, company, battalion, regimental commander, my experiences or non-experiences with racism, you know, growing up in the Marine Corps, caused me to not even focus on it as an issue at all.
Right.
And part of what I think I learned about negative leadership is if you emphasize a problem hard enough, long enough, you're going to have more of those problems. So my inclination over time was to not emphasize, not bring out the issues that seem to be socially divisive. In other words, you let those issues ride out and focus on leadership, you focus on collective unit type things, and it naturally just pulls the humans together into the tribes that you're trying to create. So, you know, I think it's a good lesson for everybody to try to apply. Is it, don't focus on the problem. Don't focus on things that you're trying to eradicate. You're not going to be successful at it. You might actually have a counterintuitive response by, you know, more of the problems that you're trying to avoid by focusing on them.
Hmm. Interesting. Phil Smith, our guest here. I was, you know, I joined in 84, my first platoon sergeant, black. And so when you come up in an organization and, you know, the guys senior to you, in charge of you, are black, I mean, I don't know that it's, you know, it's, I don't want to say it was a non-issue, but it kind of was. You know, so here's the most qualified guy who's your guy, and he's a black guy. So, and you know what? This is kind of funny, but the other day, Marine Corps Times, there was a picture, and a first lieutenant getting awarded the Navy Marine Corps Medal for saving a handful of people in Okinawa after, as they were struggling, to not drown, after scuba diving. And so the awarding officer, you can only see the back of his head. And I looked at the back of his head and said, that's Staff Sergeant Timberlake, who's now a major general. And then I looked down at the caption, Major General Craig T. Timberlake. I'm like, I know the goddamn head anywhere in the world, man. I could wake up in the middle of the night, that head would be facing behind me, and I'd be like, yeah, Timberlake's here. What's going on? And I laughed, though. I mean, I haven't seen him. Probably last time I saw him when I was a captain, but so I haven't seen him in 20-something years. You see his back of his head in the picture, and you're like, that's Timberlake. Interesting.
I hope he hasn't changed.
Oh my God. He was hell. He went through the basic school when you were teaching, cause he went, no, not when you were teaching. He jumped into the OCS class right behind me. So he put our class through, then jumped in the next one and was at the basic school, just got there when I was leaving. And so pretty interesting. And, I'll tell you what though, he was hard as nails, as a staff sergeant and, smart, tough. And the first racism I think I ever encountered was when I got to the fleet in 1984. I had a Marine by the name of Gregory who tried to kill himself by swallowing a T-bone steak bone. And I was like, what? I don't really understand.
Wow.
That.
Damn.
And he got in trouble for it. Okay, that's how so Gregory was, I don't know, he was a bit of a shit talker. Anyway.
Well, they gave him
his ass. Yeah. So, he showed up at a formation with all this gel in his hair. Right? And his head shiny, and I sent him away. And I said, go wash that shit off your head. And I had a black staff sergeant by the name of Pritchett. Take me aside later, and he said, you know, Lieutenant, that could be construed as racism. I said, what do you mean? I said, he's not supposed to have an eccentric haircut when he stands in this formation. And I almost felt like he was trying to intimidate me a little bit. And I said, look, if a white Marine had a high and tight but had dyed his hair purple, do you think he'd stand in that formation? I said, no, because it's eccentric. I said, it's the same standard. Don't show up with an eccentric hairstyle. That's how we do it. He just looked at me. But to me, that was kind of a holdover of the 70s, right, when race was a sensitive issue. And to me, it wasn't. It's like, wait a minute, who's that? Oh, that's Gregory. Get your ass out of here. Go wash your hair and then come back. And he did. He was back in 5 minutes, getting his ass chewed again. Gregory. Anyway. All right, give us an update on the wood shop before I let you go.
On the what?
On the wood shop. On the wood shop. Like, first of all, the last time we spoke, there was no heating element in the wood shop. And since your cold weather has been prolonged, you've remedied that, yes or no?
Space heaters is what I'm using.
There goes the electric bill.
Yeah, that's fine. It's like acclimatization. You get out there and you stay there for a while, you get acclimatized, pretty soon it gets hot in there. But the latest project have been
okay. Hold on.
What kind of mantles?
What kind of space heaters? Ceramic?
Oh, electric? No. Just old electric. Small things. They got a couple of them in there. Just enough to knock the temperature down a little bit or up a little bit.
Up a little bit from what 30, 40 to about maybe 50, 60.
No, probably not even that warm in there. Probably 50 maybe. Yeah.
Doesn't that affect the wood when you're working on it?
It does over time, yeah. So I'm hoping it doesn't take cold too much.
Yeah, I'm telling you, you better be careful what you do in those temperatures because it's not gonna stay.
I don't know, but I'm not moving to California regardless.
I would not try to talk you into it. I mean, it was 14 degrees in Dallas when I started the show this morning.
Yeah, that's nuts.
Isn't it? Global warming.
Makes you a believer out of climate change anyway.
No. I met a Marine. He works in North Dakota, and he's an environmental scientist. He works at a place called the Energy Environmental Research Center, EERC. And he said, Mac, because I asked him about global warming, blah, blah, blah. He said, look, as a scientist, if you look at the fluctuations, they're well within the parameters of what has happened historically here on planet Earth. The planet
since we started taking measurements, so he said, look,
so if it's within that small statistical range, trust me, it's okay. When you see it get beyond that, then we can allow Chicken Little out of his or her cage. Chicken Little, a man or a woman, do you know?
Woman, I think, yeah.
Chicken Little was a female?
I think so. Maybe it was neutral, though. I'd have to go back and check.
Chicken Little was...
It was transgender.
Was Chicken Little a woman? Let me find out here, and then I'll let you go. All right, so you're working on a mantle? Explain that to me.
Fireplace mantle. It's a free floating mantle. It's just a shelf. It's got the crown molding around the front, so it kind of looks like a box with the crown molding around it. It's made out of red oak, and we're going to attach it to the mantle. It's for a friend of mine. Actually, two of them. They've got a fireplace. It's a through fireplace. It's in a large enough room where the fireplace is on both sides. So they're matching red oak. Attach it to the brick wall by use of the ledger. You just screw the ledger into the brick, and then you put the mantle on top of it and you lock it down. So it was a lot of fun. The most challenging part of it was cutting the crown molding angles. It's a skill that I've now mastered after having done it several different times to get this thing to work.
Chicken Little was Disney's second adaptation of the fable after a propaganda cartoon made during World War II. Did you know that?
I did not know that it was used as propaganda in World War II, I guess because of all the nuclear threats and things like that.
It's a peaceful day at the local poultry farm, and our narrator introduces the audience to the locals. Cocky Locky, Henny Penny, Turkey Lurky, Ducky Lucky, Goosey Poosey, and the titular Chicken Little. What is titular? What does that mean?
Something specific about the character.
Holding or constituting a purely formal position or title without any real authority. Denoting a person or thing from whom or which the name of an artistic work or similar is taken.
All right, so Chicken Little is just a thing, then. It's not any of those other things. It's just a thing.
The birds live happy and content existence in their farmyard, knowing that they're well protected. But little do they know, outside the yard, Foxy Loxy has happened along and is intent on catching himself a chicken dinner. However, he can't hop in and help himself due to the high fence, the locks on the gates, and the farmer being armed with a shotgun. But Foxy Loxy is anything if not cunning. After all, there are other ways to swipe a chicken. So taking advice from his psychology manual, he states, why not get one when you can get them all? He reads aloud a passage telling him that the best way to manipulate the whole flock is to begin with the least intelligent. After searching the yard, Foxy identifies Chicken Little as the person to start with. He then breaks off a piece of wood from a fortune teller's sign and then disorients Chicken Little with the suggestion of a thunderstorm before dropping it on his head, pretending to be the voice of doom. So Chicken Little is a male. Damn it.
They use the pronoun, okay.
The pronoun his. Pretending to be the voice of doom, Foxy Loxy tells Little that the sky is falling and a piece of it has hit him in the head. He then goes on to tell him that he should run for his life. Chicken Little panics. He spreads the word to everybody. The sky is falling. The sky is falling. Little brings a crowd to where he believes the sky piece hit him. But the leader of the flock, Cocky Locky, inquires, that would be like Lou Corroborato, inquires about the ordeal. He immediately proves the story to be false. The crowd disperses, leaving Chicken Little humiliated. All right. Anyway. So that's the story of Chicken Little. How we got to that, I'm not exactly sure. All right.
Right here on All Marine Radio.
Exactly. Only. Hey, no, but again, I'm not sure how we got to Chicken Little. Oh, you were being Chicken Little, and I said, well, is Chicken Little a male or a woman? And then we find out that it's a propaganda cartoon made during World War II. And that is kind of interesting about spreading rumors and things like that. Love that. All right.
Yeah, so maybe Trump is Foxy Loxy.
Exactly. I just don't know.
Chickens in the hen house.
I just don't know how you deal with the media that no longer is about truth. And so when it's about their agenda and how they service that agenda, then it's problematic to say, yeah, let them, they are Walter Cronkite. As Cronkite pulls off his glasses and tells us that JFK is dead, or is Cronkite, do you remember what an earth-shaking event it was when Cronkite editorialized about the Vietnam War?
Yeah, it was huge.
It was huge. This was the voice of the news, right? Frumpy old Walter Cronkite, right? If sex sells, Cronkite was going nowhere, man. Right? But he was a news guy, and you believed him, and you believed that CBS News was after the truth. But nobody believes that anymore. And so I don't agree with the notion of fake news awards, however, I don't believe in the news anymore. It's news-tainment. It's a version of, or loosely fabricated on things that may have happened. But it's not the news. And I don't rightly know how the president deals with that. Because just the stories that have come out of the Justice Department, the FBI about, you know, their biases, you look at it and you're like, damn, right? I'm not a hater, but there's too many data points. So.
Yep. Yeah, I agree with you. And one of the things that he may be doing is, you know, focusing on the things that he can influence. And because he knows some things that perhaps we don't know, he just lets actions speak louder than words. And he's going to let the axe fall where it falls. And I think he knows where it's going to fall. So,
well, you know, I can only imagine being our mutual friend, John Kelly. You know the truth, right? And then you turn on a TV and you see the garbage that goes out over TV. And I remember saying this when I came home from Iraq. The American people don't have a chance, you know, relative to Iraq, because what gets reported is garbage. It's not the truth.
Yep.
Right?
So, I mean, the only other way you can do it is you start, you know, convincing, you know, everyday Americans to become their own journalist. And I think that's kind of where, you know, technology and information can take us is, you know, you don't have to be a mainstream media guy to be a journalist or a member of the press. So maybe there needs to be more of that.
All right. His name is Phil Smith. He's now the a East Coast woodcutter, and that is his claim to fame. You have any trips planned? You and your wife? You guys going anywhere anytime soon?
We've been thinking about a trip this summer on a river cruise somewhere out west, one of the western rivers, but we haven't decided yet.
Like a rafting thing?
Oh, no. We're beyond the rafting issue. We're talking about a
paddle boat?
Motorized tour boat type of a thing.
Yep. Alaska?
We've talked about Alaska a little bit, but we're actually thinking more of the east or the west coast rivers that we've never seen. Maybe the Columbia, the Colorado, or
Columbia. Carl Marlantis lives up that way.
Who?
Carl Marlantis. The writer. He lives up that way. All right, sir. First of all, thanks for doing this today. I appreciate it.
All right, take care.
All right.
Talk to you later.
All right, there you have it, Phil Smith, the East Coast woodcutter. Right here on All Marine Radio. Yeah, you know, fake news awards suck, but fake news sucks. And if you don't believe, I mean, I wonder what percentage of Americans believe that fake news exists. I mean, it's got to be huge. Right? Fake news. Yes or no? How could you say no to that? Fake news. Yes or no? Yes. There's no other answer than yes. All you have to do is read the news every day and then to see the stuff that major outlets like the New York Times, like CNN, and the retractions they do. It's ridiculous. Absolutely, positively ridiculous. So what do you do? Do you rely on the good nature of the American people and say, well, they'll sort it out? And then you watch this garbage go on TV every day? I don't know. That's why I say, as distasteful as they are, I don't know that, how do you push back against it? So, anyway, have a great afternoon. This program repeats itself momentarily, so don't touch that dial. All Marine Radio on a Wednesday, hump day, over and out.